moving slowly in and out, as if they were breathing. We emerged on a street I recognized. It was the boulevard with the weedy median running down the middle, and what might once have been high-end shops, catering to royals and royal hangers-on, lining the sides. Iota reached out to touch, or maybe pick, one of the enormous yellow flowers, and I grabbed his wrist.
"You don't want to do that, I. They bite."
He looked at me.
"Truly?"
"Truly." Now I could see the roof peaks of Hannah's enormous street-straddling house. Leah moved to her right and began sidling along the broken shop fronts, looking through the rain at the deserted square with its dry fountain. Hannah's cries of grief were now just short of unbearable each time her sobs rose and became shrieks. Leah looked back at last. She beckoned me forward, but patted the air with one hand. "Softly, softly." I bent down to Radar and whispered for her to hush. Then I joined the princess. Hannah was on her bejeweled throne. Across her lap was the body of her daughter. Red Molly's head lolled on one side of the throne, her legs hung down on the other. There were no songs about Joe My Love this morning. Hannah stroked Molly's orange bristles, then raised her lumpy face into the rain and let out another howl. She put one meaty arm beneath the fallen woman's neck, raised her head, and covered Molly's forehead and the remains of her blood-spattered mouth with kisses. Leah pointed to her, then raised her hands to me, palms out.
"What next?"
"This," I thought, and began walking across the square toward where Hannah sat. One hand was on the butt of Mr. Bowditch's gun. I didn't realize Radar was with me until she began to bark. They came full-throated, from deep in her chest, with a snarl each time she drew breath. Hannah looked up and saw us coming.
"Steady, girl," I said. "With me."
Hannah cast the body aside and rose. One of Red Molly's hands landed in a litter of small bones.
"You!"
she screamed, her bosom rising in a groundswell.
"You!"
"That's right," I said. "Me. I am the prince that was promised, so kneel before me and accept your fate." "That's right," I said. "Me. I am the prince that was promised, so kneel before me and accept your fate."
I didn't expect her to obey, and I wasn't wrong. She came at me in leaping strides. 5 would bring her to me. I allowed her 3. Because I didn't want to miss. I wasn't afraid. That darkness had come over me. It was cold, but clear. I suppose that's a paradox, but I stand by it. I could see that red-rimmed crack running down the center of her forehead, and as she blotted out the sky above me, screaming something I don't know what, I put 2 bullets into it. The .45 revolver was to Polly's .22 what a shotgun is to a kid's pop gun. Her boil-infested forehead caved in like a snow crust when someone stamps on it with a heavy boot. The brown snaggles of her hair flew out in back, along with a fan of blood. Her mouth fell open, revealing filed teeth that would no more rend and chew the flesh of children. Her arms flew up into the gray sky. Rain ran down her fingers. I could smell gun smoke, strong and acrid. She blundered in a half circle, as if for one more look at her dear one. Then she collapsed. I felt the thud run through the stones under my feet when she landed. Thus fell Hannah, the giantess, who guarded the sundial, the pool, and the entrance to the Field of the Monarchs behind Lillimar Palace. 4. Iota was standing in front of the right wing of Hannah's house, the kitchen wing. With him was a gray man with almost no face left. It was as if the flesh had come loose from his skull and slid downward, engulfing one eye and all of his nose. He was dressed in a blood-stained white blouse and white pants. I assumed he was, had been, Hannah's cook, the one she'd called a cockless bastard. I had no problem with him. My business was in the palace. But Leah's business with Hannah wasn't done, it seemed. She walked toward the fallen giantess, drawing her sword. Blood was pooling around Hannah's head and running between the stones. Eris stepped forward and took Leah's arm. Leah turned, and her expression needed no words. How dare you touch me?
Nah, my Lady of Galleon. I mean no disrespect, but stay just a moment, please. For me.
Leah seemed to consider, then stepped back. Eris went to the giant and spread her feet in order to walk up one of those enormous splayed legs. She hiked up her filthy skirt and pissed on the slack white flesh of Hannah's thigh. When she stepped away, tears were rolling down her cheeks. She turned to face us.
I came south from the village of Waver, a place no one has heard of nor ever will because this devil cunt laid waste to it, killing dozens. One was my granda, the other was my mother. Now do what you will, my lady.
And Eris actually dropped a curtsy. I went over to stand with Iota and the cook, who was trembling all over. I brought his palm to his forehead as he looked at me, and the cook did the same.
You brought down not one giant, but two, Iota said. If I live long, I know the chances are small, I'll never forget it. Or Eris pissing on her. Surprised your dog didn't want to have a go.
Leah stepped to the giant's side, raised her sword high above her head, and brought it down. She was a princess, and the heir to the throne, but she had been doing the work of a farm woman in exile, and she was strong. Still, it took her three swipes of the blade to sever Hannah's head. She knelt, wiped her blade on a swatch of the giant's purple dress, and resheathed it. She stepped to Iota, who bent and saluted her. When he straightened, she pointed to the 20 feet of dead giant, then to the dry fountain.
At your command, my lady, and more than willing.
He went to the body. Strong as he was, big as he was, he still had to use both hands to lift the head. It swung back and forth as he carried it to the fountain. Eris didn't see. She was weeping in Jaya's arms. Iota gave a loud grunt, and his shirt split up the sides as he heaved the head. It landed in the fountain, staring up open-eyed into the rain, like the gargoyle I'd passed on my way in. 5. We went along one of the pinwheel paths, this time with me leading. The back of the palace loomed over us, and again I knew it as a living thing. Dozing, perhaps, but with one eye open. I could swear some of the turrets had moved to new locations. The same was true of the crisscrossing stairways and the parapets, which looked like stone at one eye blink and deep green glass filled with writhing black shapes at the next. I thought about Edgar Allan Poe's poem about the haunted palace, where a hideous throng rushed out forever to laugh but smile no more. Here Mr. Bowditch's initials remained. Looking at them was like meeting a friend in a bad place. We came to the red loading doors with their traffic jam of wrecked wagons, then to the dark green flying buttresses. I led my party around them, and although it took a little longer, I heard no objections.
More voices, Iota said low. Hear 'em?
Yes, I said.
What are they? Demons? The dead?
I don't think they can hurt us. But there's power here, no doubt, and not good power.
I looked at Leah, who made a rapid circling gesture with her right hand. Hurry. I understood that. We couldn't waste this precious daylight, but I had to show her. She had to see. Because seeing is the start of understanding, of accepting a long-denied truth. 6. Our curving walkway brought us close to the pool surrounded by its ring of palms, their fronds now lying limp in the rain. I could see the high pole in the center of the sundial, but it was no longer topped with the sun. Because of radar's trip on it, the sun had ended up facing the other way. It was now showing the two moons of Empis. They also had faces, and the eyes also moved, toward each other, as if estimating the distance left between them. I could see Mr. Bowditch's final mark, AB, with an arrow from the top of the A pointing straight ahead toward the sundial. And the pool. I turned to my little party. Princess Leah, please come with me. The rest of you stay until I call. I bent to radar. You too, girl. Stay. There were no questions or protests. Leah walked beside me. I led her to the pool and gestured for her to look. She saw what remained of the mermaid, lying below water, now fouled with decomposition. She saw the shaft of the spear protruding from Elsa's midriff and the coil of intestines floating up from it. Leah gave a muffled groan that would have been a scream if it had been able to escape her. She put her hands over her eyes and collapsed on one of the benches where Empisarians who had made the trek from their towns and villages might once have sat to marvel at the beautiful creature swimming in the pool and perhaps to listen to a song. She bent over her thighs, still making those muffled groaning sounds, which to me were more terrible, more bereft than actual sobs would have been. I put my hand on her back, suddenly afraid that her inability to fully voice her grief might kill her, the way an unlucky person could choke to death on a lodgment of food in the throat. At last, she lifted her head, looked at the dull gray remains of Elsa again, then raised her face to the sky. Rain and tears ran down her smooth cheeks, across the scar of her mouth, over the red sore she had to massage open to eat, despite the pain that had to entail. She raised her fists to the gray sky and shook them. I took her hands gently in my own. It was like holding rocks. At last, they loosened and clasped mine. I waited until she looked at me. Flight Killer murdered her. If he didn't do it himself, he ordered it done. Because she was beautiful, and the force that governs him hates all beauty. The monarchs, good people like Dora, who were once whole people, the very land you are meant to rule over. What he loves is violence and pain and murder. He loves gray. When we find him, if we find him, will you kill him if I should fall? She looked at me doubtfully, her eyes swimming with tears. At last, she nodded. Even if it's Eldon? She shook her head as violently as before and pulled her hands free of mine. And from the pool where the dead mermaid lay came Leah's thrown voice, mournful and trembling.
He would never kill Elsa. He loved her.
Well, I thought, that's not exactly a no. Time was passing. Hours of daylight still remained, but I didn't know if the moons needed to kiss above Empis for the dark well to open. For all I knew, they could pass on the other side of the world with the same terrible result. The eyes of Bella and Arabella on the sundial's high center post tick-tocked back and forth as if to underline this idea. I turned and called for the others. 7. We walked around the sundial, but with an exception. Radar walked across it, stopping just long enough to piss beside the center post, which made me think of Eris and the fallen giant. The pinwheel paths merged into the broad central path. It ended at 7 doors. I tried the one in the middle and found it locked. I told it to open in the name of Leah of the Galleon, the Empessarian version of Open Sesame, and it did. That I had expected, but something else happened that I had not. The building seemed to recoil at the sound of the princess's name. I didn't see it so much as I felt it, as I had felt the thud in my feet when Hannah's 600 or 700 pounds of newly dead weight crashed to the ground. The tangle of whispering voices, heard not so much with ears as in the center of the head, suddenly stopped. I wasn't foolish enough to believe the entire palace had been cleansed. Exorcised was the word I'd used to Iota, but it was clear to me that not only the flight killer had power. It would be stronger if she could speak herself, I thought, but of course she couldn't. Inside the doors was a vast lobby. Once, like the trolley house, it had been decorated with a circular mural, but it had been splashed with black paint so that nothing remained but a few high-flying monarchs near the ceiling. I thought again of ISIS zealots destroying the cultural artifacts of civilizations that had gone before them. In the center of the lobby were a number of red-painted kiosks, not much different from the ones my dad and I had passed through many times at Guaranteed Rate Field when we went to Chicago to see the White Sox play.
"I know where we are," Iota muttered. He pointed. "Wait, Charlie. 1 minute."
He pounded up one of the ramps, looked, and ran back.
"The seats are empty. So is the field. They've all gone. Bodies as well."
Leah gave him an impatient look that seemed to ask what else had he expected, then led us to the left. We traveled a circular hallway past a number of shuttered booths that almost had to be concessions. Radar padded beside me. If there was trouble, I expected she'd sense it first, but so far she seemed alert but calm. Just past the last of the booths, I stopped, staring. The others did as well. Only Leah displayed no interest in what so amazed me. She went on a little way before she realized we weren't following. She made that circular hurry gesture again, but for the moment, we were frozen. Here, the stone side wall had been replaced by a panel of curving glass at least 30 feet long. It was dusty, everything in the palace was dusty, but we could still see what was inside, lit by a line of overhead gas jets, hooded so they acted as spotlights. I was looking into a vault, heaped with drifts of gold pellets like the ones I'd found in Mr. Bowditch's safe. They had to be worth billions of American dollars. Among them, scattered carelessly, were gems, opals, pearls, emeralds, diamonds, rubies, sapphires. Mr. Heinrich, the old limping jeweler, would have had a heart attack.
"My God," I whispered.
Eris, Jaya, and Iota seemed interested, but not even close to gobsmacked.
"I've heard of this," Iota said. "It's the treasury, ain't it, my lady? The treasury of Empis."
Leah nodded impatiently and gestured for us to come. She was right. We had to move on, but I stayed a few moments longer, drinking in that enormous cache of wealth. I thought of my many trips to see the White Sox and that one special Sunday to see the Bears play at Soldier Field. Both stadiums had glassed-in displays of memorabilia, and I thought this might be something similar. On their way to whatever game or games they'd come to see, the common ruck could stop to gape at the riches of the kingdom, no doubt protected by the king's guard during the reign of the Galleons, more recently by Hannah. I didn't know how Mr. Bowditch had gained access to it, but what he'd taken, with permission or without it, was no more than a drop in the bucket, so to speak. Leah gestured more strongly, both hands tossed back over her shoulders. We followed her. I took one look back, thinking that if I jumped into one of those drifts, I'd be in gold up to my neck. Then I thought of King Midas, who died of starvation, according to the fairy tale, because everything he tried to eat turned to gold when he touched it. 8. Further down the corridor, I began to catch a faint aroma that brought back unpleasant memories of Deep Malene. Sausages. We came to open double doors on the left. Beyond was a huge kitchen with a line of ovens set in brick, three stoves, spits for turning meat, and sinks big enough to bathe in. This was where the food was prepared for the crowds that came on game days. The oven doors were open, the stove burners dark, and there was nothing turning on the spits, but the ghostly aroma of sausages lingered. I'll never eat another one as long as I live, I thought. Maybe not steak either. Four gray men cringed against the far wall. They were wearing baggy pants and blouses similar to the ones Percy had worn, but none of them were Percy. At the sight of us, one of these unfortunates raised his apron and covered what remained of his face. The others only stared, their half-erased features showing varying degrees of dismay and fright. I went in, shrugging off Leah's attempt to pull me on down the passage. One by one, the members of the kitchen crew fell to their knees and raised their palms to their foreheads.
Nah, stand up,
I said, and was a little dismayed by the alacrity with which they obeyed.
I mean you no harm, but where is Percy? Percival. I know he was one of you.
They looked at each other, then at me, then at my dog, then at Iota hulking beside me, and, of course, they shied glances at the princess, who had come once more to the castle she'd called home. Finally, the one who had covered his face dropped his apron and stepped forward. He was trembling. I'll spare you his slurred speech. He was understandable enough.
The night soldiers came for him and took him in their grip. He shook, and then he swooned. They carried him away. I think he may be dead, great sir, for their touch kills.
That I knew, but it didn't always kill, or I would have been dead weeks ago.
Where did they take him?
They shook their heads, but I had a good idea. And if the Lord High wanted to interrogate Percival, he might still be alive. Leah, meanwhile, had seen something. She bolted across the room to the big food preparation island in the center. On it was a sheaf of papers tied with string and a quill pen, its feathers dark with grease and the nib dark with ink. She grabbed both, then made that impatient twirling gesture that said we had to go. She was right, of course. But she would have to put up with a little side trip to the apartment I had already visited. I owed Percival. We all did. And I owed Kellen, the Lord High, as well. I owed him a payback, and as we all know, payback's a bitch. 9. Not far past the kitchen, the corridor ended at a tall door crisscrossed with formidable iron bands. On it was a sign in letters 3 feet high. Looked at dead on, I could read the words "No Entry." When I turned my head to glimpse it from the peripheral vision Claw had sadly lacked, the words became a tangle of runic symbols, which, I'm sure, my cohorts could read perfectly well. Leah pointed at me. I approached the door and spoke the magic words. Bolts crashed back on the far side, and the door creaked ajar.
Should have tried that in Malene, Eris said. You could have saved us a lot of grief.
I could have said I'd never thought of it, which was true, but that wasn't all of it. I wasn't the prince then. I was still...
Still what?
Jaya asked. Still changing, I thought. Deep Malene was my cocoon. I was saved having to finish. Leah beckoned with one hand and pulled at what remained of my shirt with the other. She was right, of course. We had an apocalypse to stop. The hallway beyond the door was much wider and hung with tapestries depicting everything from fancy dress royal weddings and balls to hunting scenes and landscapes of mountains and lakes. An especially memorable one showed a sailing ship caught in the protruding claws of some giant subsurface crustacean. We walked at least half a mile before coming to double doors 10 feet high. On one was a banner showing an old man dressed in a neck-to-toe red robe. On his head was the crown I'd seen on Flight Killer's head. There was no mistaking it. On the other door was a much younger woman, also wearing a crown on her blonde curls.
King Jan and Queen Kofa,
Jaya said. Her voice was soft and awestruck.
My mother had a pillow with their faces on it. We weren't allowed to touch it, let alone lay our heads on it.
There was no need for me to speak Leah's name here. The doors opened inward at her touch. We stepped onto a wide balcony. The room below had a feeling of vastness, but it was hard to tell for sure because it was very dark. Leah sidled to her left, slipping into the shadows until she was almost gone. I heard a faint squeaking noise, followed by the smell of gas, and a low hissing from the darkness above and around us. Then, first by ones, then twos and threes, gas jets bloomed. There had to be over 100, ringing an enormous room. More lit up in a huge, many-spoked chandelier. I know you're hearing a lot of huge and great and enormous. Better get used to it, because everything was. At least until we got to the claustrophobe's nightmare, I will tell of soon. Leah was turning a small valve wheel. The gas jets brightened. The balcony was actually a gallery, lined with high-backed chairs. Below us was a circular room with a bright red flagstone floor. In the center, on a kind of dais, were two thrones, one slightly bigger than the other. Scattered about were chairs, much plusher than those on the balcony, and small divans like love seats. And it stank. The aroma was so thick and foul, it was almost visible. I could see heaps of rotted food here and there, some of it squirming with maggots. But that wasn't all. There were also piles of shit on the flagstones, and especially big piles on the two thrones. Blood, now dried to maroon, splashed the walls. Two headless bodies lay below the chandelier. Hanging from it, on either side, as if to keep it in balance, were two more. The twisted faces, bunched, almost mummified, with age. Their necks were stretched grotesquely long, but hadn't yet torn free of the heads they were supposed to support. It was like looking at the aftermath of some awful murder party.
What happened here?
Iota asked in a hoarse whisper.
My gods, what?
The princess tapped me on the arm. Her mouthless face looked both exhausted and sad. She was holding out one of the papers she'd taken from the kitchen. On one side, someone had written a complicated recipe in crabbed cursive. On the other, Leah had printed, and in a fair hand, "This was my father and mother's reception hall." She pointed to one of the hanging mummies and wrote, "I think Ludum, my father's chancellor." I put an arm around her shoulders. She laid her head all too briefly against my arm, then pulled away. "It wasn't enough to kill them, was it?" I asked. "They had to defile this place." She nodded wearily, then pointed past me to a flight of stairs. We went down them, and she led us toward another set of double doors, these stretching at least 30 feet high. Hannah could have walked through them without ducking. Leah motioned to Iota. He placed his palms against the doors, leaned forward, and pushed them open along hidden tracks. While he did that, Leah faced the beshitted thrones where her mother and father had once listened to the requests of their subjects. She dropped to one knee and put her palm to her forehead. Her tears fell on the dirty red flagstones. Silent. Silent. 10. The room beyond the reception hall would have put the nave of Notre Dame Cathedral to shame. The echoes turned the footsteps of we five into the march of a battalion. And the voices had returned, all those entwined whispers full of malice. Above us were the three spires, like great vertical tunnels full of shadowy green gleams that deepened to purest ebony. The floor we walked across was hundreds of thousands of small tiles. Once they had made an enormous monarch butterfly, and in spite of the vandalism that had chipped away at it, the shape remained. Below the central spire was a golden platform. From its center, a silver cable rose into the darkness. There was a pedestal beside it, with a large wheel protruding from its side. Leah motioned to Iota. Then she pointed at the wheel and made cranking motions. I stepped up, spat on his hands, and began to crank. He was a strong man, and he kept at it for quite a while without flagging. When he finally stepped back, I took over. The wheel turned steadily, but it was hard work. After 10 minutes or so, I felt like I was turning the damn thing through some kind of glue. There was a tap on my shoulder. Eris took over. She managed a single revolution, then Jaya took a turn. Hers was little more than a token effort, but she wanted to be part of the team. Nothing wrong with that. "What are we doing?" I asked Leah. The golden platform was pretty clearly a lift that went up the central spire, but it hadn't moved. "And why are we doing it if the flight killer has gone below?" There was a croak from thin air, almost a word. "Must," I think it was. Leah put her hands to her throat and shook her head as if to say ventriloquism was now too difficult. Then she wrote on another of the recipe papers, using Jaya's back as a support. The ink on the nib of her quill pen was very faint by the time she finished, but I could read it. "We must go up to go down. Trust me." What choice? Chapter 29. The Lift. The Spiral Staircase. Jeff. The Lord High. The Queen of Empis will do her duty. 1. Iota returned to the wheel, and now the resistance was so great that he grunted with each quarter turn. He moved it half a dozen times, the last only a few inches. Then, from somewhere overhead, a soft chime sounded. It echoed and died away. Leah motioned I to step back. She pointed to the platform. She pointed to us, then raised her arms and made an air hug. "All of us?" I asked. "Is that what you mean? Close together?" She nodded, then managed a final act of ventriloquism, clutching her throat as she did it. Tears of pain spilled down her cheeks. I didn't want to imagine her throat lined with barbed wire, but I couldn't help it.
"Dog. Middle. Now."
We humans stepped on. Radar held back, crouching and looking worried. As soon as our weight hit the platform, it began to rise.
"Radar!"
I shouted.
"Jump! Jump!"
For a second, I thought she was going to be left behind. Then, her hindquarters bunched and she leaped. Her leash was long gone, but she was still wearing her collar. Iota grabbed it and hauled her on board. We shuffled around, making room for her in the middle. She sat, looked up at me, and whined. I knew how she felt. There was hardly room for all of us, even crammed together, backs to bellies. The floor fell away. At 6 feet, we might have been able to jump without being hurt. At 12, we might have been able to jump without being killed. Then it was 18 feet, and forget about it. I was on one side with his toes over the edge. I was on the other, also with at least a quarter of my feet in open air. Eris, Jaya, and Leah were grouped around radar, Leah actually straddling her. Now the floor had to be 70 feet below us. The air was dusty, and I thought if I started sneezing, I might tumble off, which would be an ignominious end for the promised prince. The voices whispered and twined. One I heard clearly said,
"Your father's brain is eating itself."
Jaya began to sway and closed her eyes.
"I don't like the high," she said. "I never liked the high, even the barn loft. Oh, I can't do this. Let me off."
She began to struggle, raising her arms to push Eris, who bumped into Iota, almost sending him off the edge. Radar gave a bark. If she panicked and started to move around, Leah would fall, and me.
"Hold that woman, Eris," Iota growled. "Keep her still before she kills us all."
Eris reached across Radar and over Leah, who bent her knees in a half crouch. Eris got her arms around Jaya.
"Close your eyes, dear. Close your eyes and pretend this is all a dream."
Jaya closed her eyes and seized Eris around the neck. The air was colder up here, and I was slimy with sweat. I began to shiver.
"Sick,"
whispered a voice that wafted past me like a diaphanous scarf.
"Sick and slip, slip and fall."
Below me, the stone floor was now just a small square in the gloom. The wind was blowing, and the sometimes stone, sometimes glass sides of the spire creaked.
"Sick,"
the voices whispered.
"Sick and slip, slip and fall. Fall for sure."
We went on rising, which seemed insane to me with Flight Killer somewhere below us. But it was too late to change course now. I could only hope that Leah knew what she was doing. We passed among thick struts of dressed stone, topped with inches of dust, and now there was green glass on either side of us. Black shapes twined sinuously through it. The sides were narrowing in. And then, suddenly, the platform stopped. Above us, the spire narrowed into darkness. I could make out something up there, maybe a landing, but it was at least 40 feet above the stopped platform, where we stood crowded around my dog, who was ready to bolt at any second. Below us were leagues of empty air.
"What's happening?"
Eris asked.
"Why did we stop?"
Her voice was thin with terror. Jaya jerked in her arms and bumped Iota again. He waved his arms wildly to keep his balance.
"How the fuck we're supposed to get down is a better question," he growled. "This is what you call a predicament."
Leah was looking up anxiously, tracing the silver cable with her eyes.
"This ain't half a way to end the story,"
I said, and actually laughed.
400 feet up and crammed together like cattle.
I thought of shouting "Rise in the name of Leah of the Galleon," knew it was absurd, and was about to try it anyway when the platform jerked back to life. This time, I was the one waving my arms to keep from plunging over the side. I think I would have gone anyway if Leah hadn't grabbed me around the neck. Her grip was strong enough to choke my air off for a few seconds, but under the circumstances, it would have been churlish to complain. Radar scrambled to her feet, and we all swayed in unison. The platform actually seemed to be shrinking around us. The curved walls of the spire were now almost close enough to touch. I looked at the approaching landing and prayed for it to come in reach before the lift stopped again, or started to plunge. Neither happened. The platform stopped at the landing with a gentle bump. There was another chime, louder, up here, and Radar scrambled off, thumping Leah a good one with her rear end and sending her into Eris and Jaya. They teetered over the blackness. I shoved Leah with one hand and Jaya with the other. Iota pushed Eris and we tumbled onto the landing on top of one another, like clowns out of the little car at the circus. Iota began to laugh. I joined him. Eris and Jaya also began to laugh, although Jaya was weeping too. There was a fair amount of hugging. Leah put her face down on Radar's back and reached out with one hand. I took it and squeezed it. She squeezed back.
"I'd like to know something," Iota said. I'd like to know where in fuck we are, and why in fuck we came here.
I pointed to Leah and shrugged. Her deal, not mine. 2. The landing was small and there was no railing, but we were able to stand in a line, which was safer than being crammed together on a 6x6 platform of solid gold. And that platform now began to sink back down to the floor, leaving us stranded up here. Leah pointed to her right. Iota was first in line, and he began to sidle that way, looking down at the blackness of the drop and the descending lift platform. The rest of us followed, Jaya looking resolutely across to the far side of the spire. We were holding hands like a bunch of paper dolls. Probably not wise, since if one of us lost their balance, we might all go over the edge, but that didn't stop us. At the end of the landing was a low arch. Iota bent, let go of Eris's hand, and duck walked through. Radar went next, then Jaya and Leah. I came last, sparing one final look down at the descending platform, which was now almost out of sight. There was another curved catwalk on the other side of the arch, and another chasm beyond it. We had ascended almost to the top of the central spire. We were now at the top of the one on the right. Leah made her way to the head of our little parade, each of us holding her around the waist as she passed. I could hear the rapid chuff of breath in and out of her nose. I wondered how much strength it had taken her to vocalize as much as she had, and when she'd last eaten. By now, she had to be going on sheer guts. But then that was true of all of us.
Aren't you glad you came?
I whispered to Jaya as we began to move again, now shuffle-stepping around the top of this second spire.
Shut up, my prince, she whispered back.
The catwalk ended at another arch on the far side of the spire, this one blocked by a wooden door no more than 5 feet high. Magic words weren't needed. Leah ran a bolt at the top and used both hands to lift a double latch. There was no doubt she'd been up here before. I could imagine her and Eldon as children, the runts of the litter and largely forgotten, exploring a palace that had to sprawl over 70 or 100 acres, finding its ancient secrets, daring death on that platform. How had they ever been able to turn the wheel that powered it? And God knew how many other dangerous places. It was a wonder they hadn't been killed on one of their safaris. The corollary to that thought was that it would have been better for all of us if Eldon had been. Once the door was open, we could hear the sound of the wind outside. Its constant low moan made me think of the sounds Hannah had made as she held the body of her slain daughter. The landing beyond the door was only big enough for one person at a time, or perhaps, I thought, for two small, curious children standing close together. Leah went first. I followed and saw we were at the top of a narrow barrel that seemed to drop all the way to ground level. On our left was a wall of stone blocks. On the right was curving green glass with those capillaries of black floating lazily upward. The glass was thick and dark, but enough daylight strained through for me to see the way down. A narrow stairway turning on itself in a tight spiral. There was no railing. I reached out and touched the glass with my fingers. The result was startling. Those black tendrils drew together in a cloud and flocked toward my touch. I pulled my hand back in a hurry, and the black threads resumed their lazy perambulations.
But those things see us, or sense us, I thought. And they're hungry.
Don't touch the glass wall, I said to the others. I don't think they can get through, but there's no sense in riling them up.
What is rilling?
Jaya asked.
Never mind, just don't touch the glass wall.
Leah, now half a dozen steps below me, made that twirling gesture again, like an ump signaling a home run. We began our descent. 3. The stairs were better than the elevator platform, less scary, but still dangerous. They were steep, and the constant circling made us all, with the possible exception of Radar, dizzy. Looking down the center of the spiral was a bad idea. It made the vertigo worse. After Leah and I came Radar, Iota, and Jaya. Eris brought up the rear. After a descent of 100 steps or so, we came to another of those low doors. Leah passed it, but I was curious. I peered into a long room, musty and dusty, filled with dim shapes, some covered with sheets. The idea that I was looking into an enormous attic bemused me at first, but then I realized that every palace must have one. They just don't bother to put it in the storybooks. After descending further, the glass wall thicker, the light dimmer, we came to another door. I opened it and saw a corridor lit with a few guttering gas jets. Many more were out. A crumpled and dusty tapestry lay abandoned on the floor.
Leah, hold up.
She turned to me and raised her hands, palms out. Are there more doors as we go down, opening on different parts of the palace? Living quarters, perhaps? She nodded, then made the twirling gesture again, the one that said we had to push on.
Not yet. Do you know of an apartment that's lit by electricity rather than gaslight?
What I actually said, I think, was, do you know of chambers? But that wasn't why she looked puzzled. She didn't know electricity any more than Jaya had known riling, as in riling them up.
Magic lights?
I said. That, she understood. She raised 3 fingers, considered, then raised 4.
Why are we stopping?
Jaya asked.
I want to get down.
Hold your water,
Iota said.
I know what he's about. Or at least I think I do.
I thought of asking Leah if Mr. Bowditch had installed the magic lights and the generator to power them, but I already knew. Cowards bring presents. But based on what I'd seen of the old-fashioned Jenny, he'd done it long ago, probably when he'd still been Adrian instead of Howard. One of the suites graced with slave-driven electricity was almost certainly the private quarters of the late king and queen. But that wasn't the one I was interested in. Leah didn't just point down the tight spiral of the stairway. She jabbed her finger repeatedly. She had only 2 things in mind: finding Flightkiller before he could open the dark well, and assuring herself that the usurper wasn't her brother. I cared about those things as much as she did, but I cared about something else, too. I had been in the particular hell of Deep Malene, after all, as had Iota and the 2 women who had elected to come with us.
Not yet, Leah, hear me now. Do you remember a suite of rooms, one equipped with the magic lights, that had a long blue velvet sofa?
She made no sign that she did, but I remembered something else.
What about a table with a tiled surface? The tiles make a picture of a unicorn that looks almost as if it's dancing. Do you remember that?
Her eyes widened, and she nodded.
Is there a door from these stairs that opens on that part of the residences?
She put her hands on her hips, sword on one, dagger on the other, and looked at me with exasperation. She jabbed her finger downward. I fell into the vernacular I'd learned in Malene.
Na na, my lady. Say if we can enterwise that part from here. Tell me.
Reluctantly, she nodded.
Then take us there. We've still got lots of daylight.
I might actually have said a moit of daylight.
And there's other business than yours.
What business?
Jaya asked from behind me.
I think that's where we'll find the Lord High.
Then we must go there,
Eris said.
He has much to answer for.
Fucking right, I thought.
4.
We passed 3 more doors on our continuing descent, and I began to think Leah meant to bypass Kellen's cozy nest, his electrified cozy nest. Then she stopped at another door, opened it, and took a startled step backward. I steadied her with 1 hand and drew Mr. Bowditch's .45 with the other. Before I could look through the door, Radar hurried past me, wagging her tail. Leah put her palm to her forehead, not in salute, but in the distracted gesture of a woman who feels her troubles will never end. Crouching in the corridor, just past the point where the swinging door would have knocked it over, was the snab. Radar nosed it between its antennae, tail wagging. Then she dropped on her belly and the snab hopped aboard. Iota was looking over my shoulder, fascinated.
You do get around, Sir Snab, don't you? How did you find us?
I had an idea about that. Claudia had been able to hear the snab in her head, and maybe that ability was a two-way street. If so, the snab might have been tracking us with a kind of telepathic GPS. It was a crazy idea, but any crazier than a mermaid with a similar ability, or a youth-renewing sundial? As for how El Snabo had shown up here, my guess was that Leah wasn't the only one who knew the palace's secret ways. And a cricket, even a big one, could go places a human couldn't. That I'd observed for myself in Deep Maline.
Why is it here?
Eris asked.
To guide us?
If so, it had made a wasted trip, because I knew where we were, although Aaron had brought me a different way. Same wide corridor, with the gas jets enclosed in fancy glass chimneys, same tapestries, same marble statues, although the one that had reminded me of Cthulhu had fallen to the floor and broken in two, which, in my opinion, was no great loss. I put my hands on my knees and lowered my face until it was almost touching the snabs. It looked back at me fearlessly from its place on the nape of Radar's neck.
Why are you here? Were you waiting for us? What's your deal?
Claudia had said something about having to clear her mind. I tried to clear mine, and I think I did a pretty good job of it given the circumstances and the time pressure we were laboring under, but if the snab was sending telepathic messages, they weren't on my wavelength. They were on someone's, however. Jaya said,
Prince Charlie, the snab wishes you well and hopes for our success.
I didn't think she was making it up exactly, but guessed it might be wish fulfillment. Then, she said something that changed my mind. Iota listened and began to grin, revealing significant holes in his dental equipment.
Really?
He said.
I'll be dipped in shit.
Not what he said, what I heard.
Let me take care of this, Charlie. May I? As a favor to the one who spent much longer in Deep Maline than you did?
I gave him permission. I'd take it back, if I could, and use the 45, but I didn't know. The snab didn't either, or it surely would have told Jaya. Thinking of that helps, but not enough. In the whole history of the world, all the worlds, not knowing never changed a single mistake. 5. There was a good-sized hole in the wainscoting behind the pedestal where the statue of the tentacled horror had stood, which made me remember the defective gas jet in Deep Maline. A draft moaned in the hollow spaces behind the wall, and bad-smelling air puffed out.
That's where the little lord came from. Sure as cream makes butter,
Iota said. He had taken the lead in our procession, Leah close behind him. I tried to walk beside her, but she pulled ahead without giving me a glance. Raids took her place, the snab still mounted on her back. Jaya and Eris brought up the rear. We passed the gold-framed mirrors, I remembered, and came at last to the mahogany door that gave on the Lord High's apartment. Because it was one of the few with electric power, I guessed the chambers might once have belonged to Ludum, King Jan's chancellor, but I never knew for sure. Leah drew her dagger and I drew the 45, but we both stayed behind Iota. He looked at Jaya and mouthed,
Behind the door.
She nodded. Iota rapped with his big, dirty knuckles.
Anyone at home? May we come in?
Without waiting for an answer, he turned the knob, gold, of course, and drove his shoulder into the door. It flew back, and there was a grunt from behind it. Iota pulled the knob toward him, then slammed the door back again. Another grunt. A third time. A fourth. The grunt stopped. A fifth. Radar was barking. When I pulled the door toward him again, the man who had been standing behind it fell out in a heap on the thick red rug that covered the floor of the foyer. His forehead, nose, and mouth were bleeding. In one hand, he held a long knife. When he turned his face up to look at us, I recognized one of the men from the VIP box, the one with the scar on his cheek, who had been whispering to Petra. He raised the knife and flailed out with it, laying a shallow cut across Iota's hairy shin.
None of that, kitty,
I said, and stepped on the scarred man's wrist, bearing down until the man's hand opened and the knife dropped to the rug. I picked it up and tucked it into Mr. Bowditch's concho belt opposite the holster. Leah dropped to her knees beside the scarred man. He recognized her and smiled. Blood oozed from his split lips.
Princess Leah, I am Jeff. Once I put a bandage on your arm when you cut it, do you remember?
She nodded.
And once I pushed your little pony trap out of a mud hole, there were three of us, but my love for you was strong, and I pushed the hardest. Do you remember that as well?
She nodded again.
I never wanted to be a part of this, I swear to you, Princess. Will you let me go in memory of the old days when you were a child and Lilimar was fair?
She nodded that she would indeed let him go, and plunged her dagger up to the hilt into one of his upstaring eyes. 6. There was no electricity in the apartment today, but the scarred man, Jeff, J-E-F-F, or maybe he spelled it G-E-O-F-F, had turned the gas lights partway up so he could see to do his dirty work. My guess is he hadn't expected five of us, or for us to know where he was lying in wait. Not to mention the snab, a cricket buckaroo riding on my dog's back. Eris found a little brass lever that controlled the gas and turned the jets up to full. We found Kellen, in the next room, lying on an enormous canopied bed. The chamber was dark. His hands were clasped on his chest. His hair was combed back, and he was wearing the same red velvet smoking jacket he'd had on when he interrogated me. A faint blue haze hung around him. It looked like eyeshadow on his closed lids. He didn't stir as we approached and stood around his stolen bed. Never had an old man looked so dead, and he soon would be. I didn't know if there was running water in the toilet cubicle I saw to the left of the room, but there was surely a pump. I thought my old friend the Lord High could use a good bath. Jaya and Eris spoke at the same time. Jaya,
where's the snab?
Eris,
what's that sound?
It was a mix of chattering and squeaking, punctuated by quick, sharp hisses. As the sound approached, Radar began to bark. Did I notice how pale Iota had become when I turned toward the living room to see what was coming? I think so, but I'm not sure. Most of my attention was on the bedroom doorway. The snab entered in two springy leaps, then jumped aside. What followed were the hidden denizens of the palace's walls and dark places. A flood of enormous gray rats. Jaya and Eris both screamed. Leah couldn't, but she backed away against the wall, eyes wide and hands raised to the scar of her mouth. I had no doubt the snab had summoned them. It was, after all, the Lord of Small Things. Although most of the rats were bigger than it was. I stepped back from the bed. Iota stumbled, and I grabbed him. He was breathing rapidly, and I should have known then that something was wrong with him, but I was watching the rats. They swarmed up the dangling bedclothes and onto the body of the Lord High. His eyes flashed open. They were almost too bright to look at. The aura around him changed from pale blue to a deeper, purer shade. The first wave of rats were fried when they entered it. The stink of cooking meat and burning fur was atrocious, but they didn't stop. Fresh troops squirmed over the bodies of their dead comrades, chittering and biting. Kellen struggled to throw them off. An arm rose from the boiling rat pile and began to beat at them. One was clinging to his thumb, swinging back and forth like a pendulum, its tail wrapped around his bony wrist. There was no blood, for Kellen had none to give. I could see blue light giving occasional blinks through the rats covering him. He screamed, and a rat the size of a full-grown tomcat tore off his upper lip, exposing his gnashing teeth. And still the rats came, pouring through the bedroom doorway and surging up the bed until the Lord High was buried beneath a living, biting blanket of fur and tails and teeth. There was a thud beside me as Iota collapsed in the corner of the room, across from where the three women cowered and Radar barked. Leo was holding Raid's collar with both hands. White foam was coming from the corners of Iota's mouth and dripping down his chin. He looked up at me and tried to smile.
Boy.
For just a moment, I thought he was talking about the Hawaiian delicacy. Then I understood the word he couldn't finish. There was a muffled explosion and a flash of light. Rats, some on fire, some only smoldering, flew in all directions. One hit me in the chest and slid down my tattered shirt, leaving a trail of guts behind. The women who could vocalize screamed again. I heard the snab's wing start making that distinctive cricket sound. The rats obeyed at once, reversing direction and flowing back the way they'd come, leaving hundreds of bodies behind. Kellen's bed was littered with guts and soaked with rat blood. Kellen himself was a disassembled skeleton below a grinning skull lying askew on a silk pillow. I tried to pick Iota up, but he was far too heavy for me.
Eris, I shouted. Eyes down! Help me! It's bad!
She made her way through the diminishing tide of rats, hopping and crying out when they ran over her feet, but not a single one bit her, or any of us. Leah followed. Jaya hung back, then she came too. I got Iota under the arms. Eris took one leg, Leah the other. We carried him, trying not to trip over the last few rats, including one with no back legs but still pulling itself gamely along after its fellows.
Sorry,
Iota said. His voice was guttural, coming from a throat that was rapidly closing up. Foam flew.
Sorry. Wanted to see it through.
Shut up and save your breath. We laid him on the long blue sofa. He began to cough, spewing more curds of foam into Leah's face as she knelt to brush his hair back from his sweating forehead. Jaya grabbed a doily or some such thing from the unicorn table and wiped away some of the mess. Leah didn't seem to notice. Her eyes were fixed on Iota's. What I saw in hers was kindness and pity and mercy. He tried to smile at her, then looked at me.
It was on the blade of his knife. An old trick.
I nodded, thinking of how carelessly I'd shoved that knife into the concho belt. If I'd even nicked myself, I wouldn't be the only one foaming at the mouth. He looked back at Leah. He raised his arm very slowly as if it weighed 100 pounds and touched the heel of his palm to his forehead.
My queen, when the time comes, do your duty.
His hand dropped. So Iota, whom I'd first seen clinging to the bars of his cell like a monkey, passed away. After all he'd been through, and big man though he was, took but one tiny cut on the shin to do for him. His eyes were open. Leah closed them, bent, and pressed the scar of her mouth to one stubbly cheek. It was the best she could do for a kiss. Then she got up and pointed to the door. We followed, stepping around the corpses of a few rats that had died on the way out. She stopped before going into the corridor, looked back, and put her hands to her throat. Iota spoke one last time, as Falada had spoken, and the snab.
The Queen of Empus will do her duty. This I swear.
Chapter 30. One More Stop. The Dungeon. Resolute. Impossible Stars. The Dark Well. Gog Magog. The Bite. 1. We followed a trail of dead and wounded rats to the hole in the wainscoting. Eris actually helped one three-legged bruiser get inside, then grimaced and wiped her hands on her shirt, which couldn't have done much good, covered in dirt and blood as it was. We came to the door giving on the spiral stairs, which I guessed might be some sort of emergency exit for the royalty in case of fire. I tapped Leah on the shoulder.
"One more stop before we go after Flight Killer," I said. "On the level of Deep Malene and the torture chamber, will you do that?"
She made no protest, only gave a weary nod. There was still a curd of bloody foam on her cheek. I reached out to wipe it away, and this time she didn't shrink back.
"Thank you. There may be someone there who helped us."
She turned away before I could finish. Outside the palace, Woody and Claudia and their followers, by now they might be swelled to the size of a real army, had probably entered the city. If there was a barracks where the remaining night soldiers slept, the Grey Folk could be slaughtering them even now, and hooray for that, but in here, time was fleeting, and there was no magic sundial to turn it back. We went down the staircase, down and down, around and around. None of us spoke. The death of Iota sat on us like a weight. Even Radar felt it. She couldn't stay beside me. The barrel we were descending was too narrow for that, but she walked with her nose touching my calf, ears down and tail drooping. The air got chillier. Water oozed from the lichen growing on stone blocks that had been placed here hundreds of years before. No, I thought. Longer than that. Thousands, maybe. Then I started to smell something, very faintly.
"High gods,"
Eris said, and laughed. There was nothing cheerful about it.
"The wheel turns, and here we are, back where we came from."
We had passed several more doors on our way down, some large, some smaller. Leah stopped at a small one, pointed, then went down several more steps to give me room. I tried the door. It opened. I had to bend almost double to go through. I found myself in another kitchen, this one little more than a closet compared to the one we'd passed on our way in. Here there was only one stove, no oven, and a long, low grill, probably powered by gas, but now out. On it was a row of sausages, burned black. Jaya made a sound between a cough and a retch. I suppose she was thinking of all the meals we'd taken in our cells, especially the ones before playtime and the first round of the fair one. I had read about PTSD, but reading about something and understanding it are very different things. On a shelf beside the grill was a tin cup like those we'd had in our cells, only this one had no hole in the bottom you had to put your finger over. It was filled with sulfur matches like the kind Percy had given me. I grabbed it, and since I had no pockets, I relocated the .45 in the concho belt and poked the cup of matches into the holster. Leah led us to the door, peeked out, then gestured for us to follow, twirling her fingers as before, quickly, quickly. I wondered how much time had passed. It was still daylight, surely, but what would that matter if Bella and Arabella kissed on the other side of the world? I guessed that the Flight Killer was already at the Dark Well, waiting for it to open so he could try to make another bargain with the thing that lived there, either blind to the terrible events that might result or not caring. I thought the latter more likely. Eldin of the Galleon, Eldin the Flight Killer, a flabby, greedy, green-faced goblin waiting to call something from another world into this one, and then, perhaps, into mine. I considered telling Leah to forget about taking us to the torture chamber. Percival, might not even be there, or he might be dead. Surely stopping Flight Killer was more important. Eris touched my shoulder.
"Prince Charlie, are you sure about this? Is it wise?"
No, it wasn't. except without Percival, a man with the gray disease so advanced in him he could barely talk, none of us would be here.
We go,
I said curtly. Eris touched her palm to her forehead and said no more. 2. I recognized the passage where Leah was waiting for us, shifting from foot to foot, clasping and unclasping the hilt of her sword. To the right of the auxiliary kitchen was the way to the dungeon. To the left, and not far, was the torture chamber. I ran, leaving the others behind, except for Radar, who loped beside me, tongue flying from the side of her mouth. It was farther than I remembered. When I reached the open door of the chamber, I paused long enough to think something that wasn't quite a prayer, just, please, please. Then I went in. At first, I thought it was empty. Unless that was, Percival had been enclosed in the Iron Maiden. But if he had been, blood would surely have been oozing out, and there wasn't any. Then a pile of rags in the far corner stirred. It raised its head, saw me, and tried to smile with what remained of its mouth.
Percy!
I shouted, and ran to him.
Percival!
He struggled to salute me.
Nah, nah, it's I who should salute you. Can you stand?
With my help, he was able to get to his feet. I thought he'd wrapped one of his hands in a dirty piece of the blouse he wore, but when I looked at it more closely, I saw it had been wrapped around his wrist instead and knotted tightly to stop the bleeding. I could see a dark, crusty patch on the stones where he'd been lying. His hand was gone. Some bastard had chopped it off. The others arrived. Jaya and Eris stood in the doorway, but Leah came in. Percival saw her and raised his remaining hand to his brow. He began to cry.
Hinsa!
It was the closest he could get to princess. He tried to bend a leg to her and would have fallen if I hadn't held him up. He was filthy, bloody, and disfigured.